G'day humans, welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas, and dangerous ideas are aplenty on the Christian nationalist right at the moment, whether it's Trump in America or Nigel Farage leading in the polls, in some polls in the United Kingdom, or the National Rally in France, or the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, or Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party in Australia, which is now the second most popular party in Australia. Incredible, since it was only really a 2 or 3 percentage point game just a few years ago. I thought it was time for us to understand what the new energized young nationalist right is actually all about. Not the far right, not white supremacists, but people who are completely changing what conservatism means in Western liberal democracies. You'll be familiar probably with Turning Point USA, the organization founded by Charlie Kirk, who was assassinated last year. Today's conversation is with the head of the Australian chapter of Turning Point, the leader of Turning Point Australia. He's not your average Christian nationalist. He's a 28-year-old Lebanese-Australian influencer, educator, and activist who was tapped by Nigel Farage himself and introduced to Charlie Kirk. And Farage encouraged Kirk to allow Joel to set up Turning Point in Australia. He originally had gained some notoriety in Australia for his online conversations about Australia's COVID lockdowns and sort of championing a populist uprising against those. And he now has more than 600,000 followers. He has over 1 billion views. He has a newspaper. He has a podcast. A lot of this will be news to normies in Australia because this all occurs in a political sphere that is unfamiliar to the mainstream. But we have to pay attention to it and we have to understand what it is that they're thinking. This is not your grandpappy's Conservative Party. This is something altogether new. So Joel Jamal joins us to debate immigration and Brexit and Trump and the future of democracy. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. The one, the only, Joel Jamal. I love the fact that you've brought in plastic straws. This is, so I'm holding up, for people who aren't watching the video, this is an actual bag of 100 blue and green plastic bendy drinking straws, currently illegal. This is contraband, right?
You can't sell it in New South Wales, but you can gift them.
Possession is all right.
Possession's fine, yeah.
What's the penalty for sale?
Oh, that'd be some sort of like $5,000 or yeah, $5,000 to $100,000 fine in New South Wales, thanks to...
Yep.
One of our government ministers.
How did you acquire them?
So I
assume you didn't make them.
No. Well, we're in the process of making them. But
don't say that.
That's another story.
You get arrested.
Come at me, guys. Come at me. Yeah. But no, with the I was in the US recently for the Turning Point USA conference, and we were wrapping up, and some of the young folks took me to an Aussie, one of those Outback steakhouse places.
Oh, yeah. You know that's not Australian.
And yeah, I know.
Yeah,
I,
of course.
I,
yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
But they felt that they wanted to give me a sending off gift. And, you know, we wrapped up dinner and whatever. And I said, there's just one more thing before I fly out tomorrow.
Mm.
I need to get some plastic straws.
Right.
And I said this like, not even as a joke. I was like, I actually need to get them. And they thought I was joking.
Right.
They proceeded to take me to the local store. And I grabbed 3,000 of these suckers.
Amazing.
They're great gifts. In summer, you know, you grab a frozen Coke.
Can I keep these?
No, yeah, they're yours.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if
I
pay you 1 cent for them, then we're breaking. Then I'm breaking
the law.
That's
right. It'll be going. Yeah, absolutely. That's
so. What comic was it who was saying, like, isn't it possible? Do we not have the capacity, like, as a civilization, we've sent men to the moon and we can't invent a straw that lasts longer than 5 minutes and shorter than 10,000 years?
Well, there are.
But why is that? We've got paper straws that crumble in your mouth after 5 minutes, and we've got these plastic straws, which will be up a turtle's nose for the next 10,000 years.
It's ridiculous, and as we were saying before, it sort of embodies the problem with more modern wokeism, leftism, where it's sort of like it feels good to ban it. We're going hard on it, but you go to some of our local stores here, like maybe Coles or Woolies, the big ones, and they everything's wrapped in plastic. It's like, that's, you know.
Yeah.
So they come down
it
hard.
Is funny that there's, well, I think things get, and I don't know how I feel about the plastic straw ban. It's not a big issue for me to have to use paper straws, but it strikes me that the motivation behind it is that people glommed onto a particularly iconic image. I think people were talking about there was a turtle with a straw up its nose. Is that what, have you heard of that? It was apparently a photo with a turtle with a straw up its nose.
Right.
which to me means don't leave your fucking straws in the water and don't litter. Like, if there's a littering problem, I understand. So don't litter. And if you want to crack down on litter, although you probably would object also to people cracking down on litter because that would be a civil libertarian infringement, wouldn't it?
No, I absolutely think we should. I think we need clean streets. I think it's actually a part of nationalism. If you're proud of your country, we should actively, you know, how many greenies do you see out there on Extinction Day saying, let's go do Plant a Tree Day. Let's go do Clean Up Your Local Community Day. You never see it.
And I don't know. Maybe they do.
Look, maybe not, but I think that with the plastic straw thing is a bit of a woke sort of indication of I'm a good person, I'm going to come down like a Nazi on this insignificant thing, when in actuality, the vast majority of the waste going out into the waterways is actually from many rivers coming from third world countries. And so rather than clamp down on Australians that are actually, you know,
that are proudly shoving our plastic straws up the noses of every turtle we can find. But I don't, for me, it's not even a woke. For me, it's just a technological thing. Like, can't engineers figure out a plastic that will dissolve?
There are plant-based ones.
Yeah. Can't you have one that only lasts for hours in liquid instead of.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of groups. They have these little bamboo ones. They have these.
I've got metal ones at home. Yeah, have you got those?
I use a glass one.
Yep.
Yeah, at home. Yep, but it's just ridiculous. I mean, the fact that we've had to start off the podcast with this,
well, you brought them. I mean, why I wasn't planning on starting to talk about plastic straws.
But this is kind of a motif of the larger thing going on in society. It's that we used to not talk about these things. I was listening to Douglas Murray talk about this. He was like, we should be talking about how we build underworld cities. We should be talking about how we get, why are we talking about this stuff, which until yesterday wasn't a problem?
Well, to be fair, nobody is talking about this stuff apart from people like you.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Look, when I rock up to the Maccas and I wave one of these things, all of them are like, oh, can I have some too? So, I mean, I think these things, they do encroach on the average people in the world, and it is kind of an annoyance in the background. Mm. But again, this isn't the move, you know, economy shaping stuff.
But I mean, it is a good, it maybe is a better way into the conversation than you think it is, in the sense that it's evidence of what your critics would say is the modus operandi of the new right, which is find some largely irrelevant little distracting way in which woke people are being stupid, and then say, because they're taking our paper straws away, we should overhaul liberal democracy and, you know, implement a Christian nationalist economy or something like that.
But they started it. Hang on. It's always funny to me when we see some of these cultural Marxists, they come out and they say, why are you fascinated with this? Why are you fascinated with that? It's like, you started it. You're literally defined as cultural Marxist.
Well, who defines themselves as a cultural Marxist?
Well, it'd be a lot of university professors, a lot of revolutionaries on the streets that we often see at the protests, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But
they wouldn't define themselves as cultural Marxists, would they? What do you mean by it? There might be an old cardigan-wearing professor in some Ivy League university who still calls himself a Marxist, but
it's literally littered throughout their philosophy, through their language. They talk about actually pulling apart society, pulling off the old shackles. I mean, this is rooted throughout feminism. This is rooted throughout. I mean, Quillette often writes about this and how we've got to pull down the old. I did a video this week about some of the founding feminists out there and some of the quotes, and it's actually quite genocidal and horrific when you actually read what they're talking about. We need less men. We need to pull down the old shackles of society. And look, the straws is a tiny element of that, but it is sort of, it's like a way to beat down Western colonial powers, including countries like Australia.
So you're saying it's one small piece of evidence of a bigger phenomenon. Yeah. And you say Marxism. Why? Because, what's the relevance of, Marx's theory of labor to a feminist who's angry about men?
Yeah, well, I think Marxism, it wants to tear down the old order. So let's define the exact sort of person they go after. They go after white men. They go after Christians. They go after men that basically were men of competence, men that were in, let's say, attuned with their aggressive side or their more masculine side. I think that that's an issue for these people because they see it as a threat. And so they see that as something to neutralize. That's how they see it, I believe, in society. So Marxists, they do want to tear down the old order. That starts in the universities.
You mean revolutionary, really?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's almost Maoist more. It's like a cultural revolution rather than, I mean, Marx was mostly focused on economics, but you're not accusing woke social justice lefties of being, sort of neo-communists. You're saying that they share with Marx and maybe with Mao or Lenin or Pol Pot or whoever, like a desire to start again from year zero in a more egalitarian society or something.
Look, Josh, I'm no Jordan Peterson here. I'm not going to intellectualize this word or that word. The average punter in the street looks at what's happening in the world, and things that they used to have yesterday are up for contention today, and quite offensive. Could be racist, could be this or that. That's where it's like, so if people see you using plastic, the idea that you're killing the environment. It's like, no, I'm just using it because I've been using it since I was a child.
Right.
And I think that's where it's starting to percolate into the real world.
But when you say that people look around the world and they see that things that were taken for granted are now up in the air, I think that's true. Yeah. When I look around the world and see things that were taken for granted that are up in the air, I think about the attack on liberal democracy and, the civic institutions and anti-corruption and the separation of powers and not using police forces as your own private militias humane immigration policies. And I see those things as being the most consequential things that are now up in the air.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks to people on your side of the aisle.
Sure.
Not whether or not we can have straws.
Yeah, look, it's not my starting argument. That's for sure. It's not my starting argument. But I
shouldn't have brought those bloody straws.
Not at all, man. It was a gift. I didn't think it'd make it into the shot. But no, with I actually agree with all those things. A lot of people probably would be surprised with my agreement on this stuff. I do have quite a libertarian streak with this stuff. I did oppose the foreign wars. And I do think that you're right about immigration. I mean, there's got to be a moral element to it as well, especially when these foreign wars go hand in hand with a moral immigration policy. You're displacing people, and the idea that you're not going to take any in as a humanitarian, there's humanitarian arguments for that. But also, I mean, we just saw this week in Australia, our intelligence agencies almost threatening the ABC, our state media, which kind of brings back memories.
Publicly funded media. State media implies the state.
They're listed on. I think they're listed
on Twitter. The leaders have control over.
Yeah, but they do. But they do receive $1 billion.
That's right.
Year,
Elon, called because the ABC was critical of him. He called he changed the description on X of the ABC from public broadcaster, I think, to state media.
Yeah.
Just cheeky and wrong.
But to us, we see a headline like that ACO is like, I know you're about to release part two of this documentary about the failings of the intelligence agencies with the Bondi massacre that happened a month ago, but he cautioned them. And to you and me, we're in the circle. We know, hey, this might mean a raid of ABC's offices because that's happened before.
Mm.
Correct me if I'm
wrong. I was in the building when the feds raided the newsroom, actually. I don't remember what that was over. I think it was about
whistleblower.
Yeah, it was about Afghanistan war crimes. Yeah. Must have been 2022, maybe. I think it was, it was reasonably recent. So anyway, Turning Point Australia. Let's just start there. What is Turning Point Australia? How did you come to be in charge of it? What's his relationship to the American chapter and Charlie Kirk?
It's a great question because I am not a politics guy. I'm a construction guy and a property development guy. I lost my job due to the lockdowns in 2020. I got made redundant because the lockdowns essentially tightened up funding for projects, which never went ahead. But when it comes to Turning Point, the mission that Charlie Kirk set out on 13 years ago, at 18 years old, he decided not to go to university, didn't want to go to college and get some, liberal dance, theory lessons.
Silly lesbian whale hugging, tree hugging, not worth the paper it's printed on degree.
No. He wanted to basically help people understand how to breathe their values into politics. He felt that there was a gap in the market for educating people about civics, He decided to start at the universities because he felt that they were the factory of bad ideas. Some of the ideologies that we were throwing around before, Maoist, Marxist, cultural Marxist ideas. And he wanted to basically help engage young people in their democracy, help them understand there's actually a better way, because the universities really did used to have a bit more of a healthy dialogue. Now it's become quite demagoguery. And that's something we've got to push against that across all ends of the spectrum, on the left and the right. And he very much saw 13 years ago there was a real issue. So today, fast forward, he's just passed away, and it does feel like there's a massive hole without him in the public sphere, because he was a bridge builder. He was someone that he loved the battle of ideas. He loved to debate the issues and go to the universities and have it out and have a beer after. Now, the guy set up thousands of chapters across America, high schools even, they started to percolate into, and universities. And in Australia, we started 4 years ago. We had a different start. We didn't start in the universities. We started and were born out of the COVID movement, covering the protests on the ground, helping people understand who's punching them, why they're punching them, how can they punch back politically. Things that they took for granted before, perhaps like the media being the guardians of democracy, we're all of a sudden taking these tax breaks from the government and towing government lines on vaccines, which ended up being untrue, lockdowns, which ended up being a net negative. And so when we look back at the start of our organization, I was privileged to and blessed to take it on thanks to Nigel Farage. I was a part of a tour that he did to Australia, and he toured here 3 or 4 times, and he basically made the connection to Charlie and said, hey, these are the guys that have already been doing your work here, but they would, so they've proved themselves. If they had the Turning Point brand, they could take it to another level. And so for 4 years now, we've accrued 600,000 followers online. Last year, we just crossed the 1 billion view mark in October. But we averaged about 220 million views last year in total. And when election time comes around, we do how to vote cards. We show people who to vote for that are standing up for Christian, conservative, libertarian values, and really how to make government smaller. And so that's how we've really carved out our space in Australia. And the responsibility isn't lost on me. I do feel that there's an enormous gap with Charlie gone in the American market. I see some of the silly debates going on over there right now, and I'm just thinking, what would Charlie say? He's kind of been deified recently. Mm. But that's how we came about.
Yeah, and so it's would you say that it's mainly a political movement in Australia in the sense of the influences to try to get people into elected office? Would Turning Point Australia run candidates at some point in the future,
never,
do you imagine?
No, not at all.
Why not? Why not make it a political party?
Well, first off, the US told us you're not allowed to.
That's a good reason.
But nor would I. And the reason for that is I had a very bad experience in political parties. I was part of the Christian Democrat Party, which was Fred Niles' party. And
yep. That's a family values, conservative party.
You'd think they'd conduct themselves in a Christian manner. Turns out it was very much not like that. In fact, one of the early things—
I'm shocked. You mean there could be hypocrisy among family values Christian conservatives?
Yeah, well—
this is the first time I've ever heard of such a thing.
You can imagine at 19 for me, starry-eyed, rosy-colored glasses, I came out thinking that they would be above reproach, but if this is how bad they were, and we're talking like— and this is all in the past. The party's been wound up. No one could come after me legally now, to be clear. But I called it out when I was 19, before I was a public figure. And I said, hey, you've got 13 discrepancies. There's hundreds of thousands in legal transfers. You've got nepotism happening. You've got board members that don't understand their obligations. This is jailable stuff. And when I called it out, they just came after me. And it told me that you aren't loyal to the party like they are. You're loyal to your values. And so the mission for Australia's Turning Point, just like the US, you must stick to your values. You must be consistent, as Charlie was. And to run in a political election is not the job. The job is to muster the troops. The job is to pull the existing politicians, no matter who they are. I'm a fan of Pauline Hanson, for example, but we've called her out on the Hate Crimes Amendment Bill before the last election. We're consistent about that because we're not about— parties come and go, politicians come and go, but our values are what we make us Australians.
And for non-Australian listeners, Pauline Hanson is a right-wing anti-immigrant politician who's been around for decades. Mm. And I should also just add, I have no knowledge of the claims that you're making about the Fred Nile Party, so I don't really seem to be endorsing you know, allegations of illegality that, as far as I'm aware, that does not... I can't say that that's true.
That's fine. No, that's fine. Disclaimer.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do I am I right in understanding that COVID was quite personal for you in the sense that your dad died not from COVID, but from COVID lockdowns in your telling of the story?
Well, his story was one of many. In my situation, when I started, I got made redundant. Four of my siblings and their partners, they lost 8 jobs between them. Some of them had 2 jobs. And my dad was getting cancer
treatment.
Just
pause on that for a second, because my recollection of the way that the government handled COVID was, just economically speaking, one of the best in the world, in the sense that anyone who was on a payroll, just the company was paid to keep them on the payroll. And so companies made an absolute fortune just collecting money from the government and then paying their employees.
Look, Josh, we
government can, money just to keep them on the books.
We can look at these things in the macro, but I can tell you that there are plenty of people that lost their jobs, including in my family. We lost 8. And
is that because they were self-employed or something?
No, they worked for big employers, you know. Okay. And so, look, when I look at what's going on, I think one of them had just reduced hours, but 7 of them lost their jobs. I lost my job. And what that meant was that, you know, we got decimated in that sense. But even with my father, he was fighting a 5-year cancer battle. And unfortunately, he was getting cancer treatment in Mexico, blood transfusions, which aren't legal in Australia, but it was actually working for him. He was making quite good progress in 2019. And when lockdowns came in February, March, he couldn't leave the country. He couldn't get out. He couldn't do that treatment. And unfortunately, that cost him his life. And I just started my show 4 weeks in, and I'd already got 350,000 viewers from basically a stationary start with nothing but iPhones. And so there was clearly a market. And then losing my dad was just fuel. It was like, all right. And look, my story is not special. There were so many people that we hear this from economists like G.G. Foster, that this is actually the way the government measured the impact of lockdowns doesn't take into consideration people not getting screened for cancer early on where they could affect it. But also with inflation, I mean, the government inflation here, we are still feeling the effects of that today, thanks to the Conservative government, the Liberals under the Treasurer then. And unfortunately, this is a problem that faced many Western countries like America.
Mm. Oh, I'm sorry to hear about your dad, and that must have been awful. I just have to put a note of dissent into what you were saying about vaccines and lockdowns, in the sense that when you said that the media turned out to be misreporting on vaccines and on lockdowns, the main way in which the media got vaccines wrong was by not being sufficiently critical of the government's procurement process here, I would say, and also being too gullible about the impact that it would have on transmission.
Sure.
But they were right on the safety of the vaccines, and they were right on the fact that the vaccines are overwhelmingly effective about preventing you from dying of COVID.
Yeah.
And on lockdowns, I think they took too long to start having a mature conversation about when lockdowns should end and when border closures should be eased, especially between states and so on. But fundamentally, I mean, Australia had 90% fewer deaths than the United States did per capita.
We did
emerge amongst one of the best countries in the world. You know, if you don't count what many regard as being the abuses of human rights in terms of people not being able to protest and go to cafes if they weren't vaccinated and stuff like that.
But look, Josh, I appreciate that these are significant claims, and you know, last thing I want is for this podcast to get a lawsuit. But I stand firmly on the having built the following at that time, I was inundated and on the front lines with a lot of these fights for people with their jobs, fathers that got the vaccine so that his wife could stop working so she didn't have to get the vaccine, and then him getting injured. In my own family, we know that the both the Pfizer and the AstraZeneca effects those with the last name Jamal, because my first cousin, for example, he ended up getting myocarditis and pericarditis from Pfizer, And my brother, when he was driving back home from the first vaccine for AstraZeneca, he started to go blind in his eyes. And so these are real stories and real people out there that can't be washed away with a lawsuit threat from some of these organizations. And it would be remiss of me to wipe clean the media's. There was no apology. There was no nothing. And I can't tell you how the music to people's ears when they heard, if they were to hear an apology on that stuff. These are real people that
But what exactly would the apology be? Because myocarditis, you're something like 5 to 8 times likelier to get myocarditis from COVID than you are from the vaccine, which doesn't mean that the vaccine doesn't cause it. But there was a lot of misunderstanding and fear-mongering at the time about the risk of that. I assume your brother was okay after the myocarditis.
No, yeah. He was. He did continue to get a bit sick after that.
Yeah, you know, I know people who got myocarditis from the vaccine, but, you know, global pandemics are not fun. No matter what you do, like no matter what policy settings you apply, people are going to get hurt, people are going to lose their jobs, economies are going to shrink. The idea that things would have been better if we hadn't injected money into the economy.
I think the
government. They would have been better if we hadn't, pressured people into getting vaccines.
The problem is, the real question is, what society do we want to live in? Where there are risks, there must be a choice. The federal data that was used on people's medical records should never have been weaponized to enforce mandates. It should never have happened. People should have been given the option to do these things. When news came out that this doesn't actually stop the spread, that you then straight away mandates should have gone out the window. And that's not what happened. And so when I look at where there's a risk, there must be a choice. And so with me, I got COVID. I didn't get myocarditis. I was fine. And the idea that we locked down the schools when the data showed the kids had a better chance of surviving than me, I mean, are we following the data or are we not?
Mm.
And I just think that this highlighted a lot of issues in Australia. And when I say apologize, do we or do we not want to live in a country where we own up to our to what's going on, or do we want to be like Trump, where he owns up to nothing? And so I think I would like to see it in Australia where we can actually have these discussions and we can actually hold our leaders to account. That's what transparency is about. But with our politicians, we saw an interesting face, which keeps coming up. They delegated all their authority to bureaucrats that were unelected and unaccountable as a result. Again, you won't get everything right. But the cowardice of the politicians and the inability for the media to hold them to account was a huge issue. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had a following. I built my following off that. And it's
no, continuing. I mean, but yes, but the mere fact of building a following doesn't indicate whether or not the people who are following you are correct.
Of course. Right?
I mean, people might be misguided. They may not be epidemiologists. They may not know whether or not the bad reality is better than the worse reality that would emerge if they
totally agree.
If we didn't have lockdowns or something. But I completely agree with you that once it was obvious that transmission was not really aided, although it is a bit, because if you've got full blown COVID and you're coughing and spluttering everywhere, then you are more contagious than someone who has been vaccinated and isn't symptomatic. But once it was obvious that it was not the gold, the sort of solution that we thought that it might be, then still having many, many months or years in which people had to show their vaccination papers was silly. School closures were silly, although we were pretty good about that as far internationally. I mean, you got to remember, in places where people were given the choice earlier, so the parts of the states in the United States with the lowest uptake of vaccines had the highest mortality and the longest tail in terms of the way you get back to school quickly is you do what New South Wales did, which is you lock down fast and hard and you eliminate the virus, and then you scramble to get a vaccine and the schools can reopen in the meantime.
Okay, but then to lock down the construction sites who hadn't had one registered case, when I gave my speech on town hall steps in Sydney, we were at about 33% first vaccination in New South Wales. Gladys Berejiklian came out and announced, we are locking down the construction sites and closing all construction sites. When in actuality,
this is because there was an outbreak of Delta.
There was not one registered case attributed to any of these construction sites, as at the time Minister of the Government pointed out. Where are we
not
following
construction sites specifically, but just for context to the international listener? I assume you're talking about probably August of 2021, something like that.
This is July, actually.
July 2021. Yeah. So that would have been when we'd be at 33%. I would assume that was the winter here that Delta hit and upended all of the epidemiological assumptions that New South Wales's strategy had been based on. And we had previously done a pretty good job of turning the dial up and down and ramping it up and down and sort of keeping it out. And it was occasionally escaping from quarantine hotels as people came back into the country. But then we would have sort of, I think the New South Wales government was pretty good at titrating the level of control to the level of the threat. Mm. Delta was much, much more infectious. It escaped. And then it was a question of, do we all just lock ourselves inside for 100 days while we can all get vaccinated? Or do we not? And do we endure potentially what Italy did in February of 2020 or what New York did? And that was a line ball call, and I could see an argument for it.
And let's be fair. I mean, the first lockdowns in 2020, totally fair. I was pushing for it. Everyone was pushing for it. But by the time we got to 2021, we actually had enough data to show from the UK at the time and from other countries like Sweden at the time that this was actually probably not the best course of action. Tony Abbott wrote the legislation in this country, our former prime minister, and he ended up basically saying, I didn't want to mandate lockdowns into the legislation. Because if a virus is that bad, he trusted the individual to lock down and to do that themselves. And that is the real clash of worldviews here. One is an authoritarian one that enforces what they think is right without bringing the people along for the ride through transparency and accountability. Another is one where Tony Abbott was putting forward, which is if you trust people, they will. If it's really that dangerous, people will do the right thing, especially if you give them the choice. And so,
is there anywhere where that happened?
In the world? Look, again, you're talking
where about people voluntarily locked down to such an extent that they eliminated the...
I do believe there might have been parts of Asia, but again, you're talking to the wrong guy. But the point is...
I don't think it... But it matters. It matters when people make claims like that, whether or not reality bears them out.
I will call on the authority of Gigi Foster. She's a phenomenal guest. The point is, I could have talked forever about this closer to the time. We're now almost 4 years, 5 years since that kicked off. So it was a little bit fresher in my mind back then. But let's proceed to see what happened when citizens did come out and did try to say, hey, I'm losing my job. I can't feed myself. The government's actually not giving me what I need for this. The town hall protest in Sydney was the last time we really saw the brutality of the police like we saw this week. That was citizens coming out. By the count at the time, the police were saying 3,500. It was more like 50,000 from people that were with me there. They proceeded to have open Crime Stoppers. They started a task force. They tried to throw me in prison for 6 months for giving a speech that the police asked me to do. I ended up winning that and getting let off. But the idea that We our own fellow Australians were saying, I need help. And instead they got slapped down. This is really damaging to the social fabric of our country. And this, people may see them unlinked, but when the voice referendum came around, a lot of people voted against that, not because of the proposal, but because they felt that they were hard done by for the last 3 years before that. And this was a way to thump the establishment and say, oh, this is your precious voice. This is something where all the unions, the banks, Coles and Woolies and all the big institutions and the media want. Well, I'm not going to vote against it. And we saw a massive whopping 60 to 70% of people not voting for this proposal.
This was the proposal last year was it last year or was it
2024?
2023,
October.
Oh my goodness.
It was a week after October 7th. So it was 14th of October. Same day.
This was the referendum to amend the Australian Constitution to create a body for Indigenous Australians that would advise Parliament. I'll grant you that towards the end of COVID, the level of authoritarianism and sort of like bully tactics was completely disproportionate to the threat that still existed. I think Tony Abbott makes a good point in the sense that that people will self-lock down to some extent if the virus is bad enough. Mm. The counterpoint I would make to that is that in some ways that proves the opposite case than the one that he thinks it does, because the majority of epidemiologists and economists who favored harsh lockdowns, their point was if you don't eliminate it, you'll have a long, bad economic consequence, which will go on for a much longer time, as it did in the UK and in the US, actually, than it did here, because people will voluntarily stay at home. No one's going to want to go out to a pub or a restaurant or a movie theater if it might land them in bed feeling with the worst flu of their life for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So the economy will be stalled for longer if you leave it up to people's own devices than if you just make everybody lock down for a short period of time. But
I'm not an expert, but the problem is we had pandemic plans and they went out the window the moment this came along. And unfortunately, the real question we've got to ask as taxpayers that employ these bureaucrats and these politicians, if the plan that you had going into this thing went out the window, what are we paying you for?
But did it?
It did. No.
You mean the Tony Abbott?
Not that. That was the legislation he wrote.
Okay.
But he made the point that we have pandemic plans and it went totally out the window. He said that.
I mean, Australia's response was pretty textbook pandemic plan. Like that is what you do.
September 20th.
Shut the borders to keep it out.
Yeah.
Lock everybody down. You contact trace aggressively. You pump a lot of money into the economy. You pay employers not to fire their employees by pegging that money to their continued employment. That is what most pandemic experts.
Sure. Science isn't a democracy. But the point is, Tony Abbott made this point in September 2021 on a podcast that he made with the IPA, and he made this point, and I think that that's when he was calling for a Royal Commission, which still hasn't happened. So where is the accountability? And so this goes back to the overarching theme of what I love what you're about with all this stuff, Josh, is that we need greater transparency as taxpayers in a government that is meant to be for us. And there is a growing distrust, which we're seeing in the polls in this country, between the elites on the left and the elites on the right, which is why we're seeing the major parties poll at less than half of the country, when before they used to have 90% of the country wrapped up. And so this is a really fascinating theme that keeps coming up with The Voice. It's come up in recent polling. I believe we're going to see it in the next elections with minor left parties eating away at Labor and minor right parties eating at our conservative parties.
Mm.
It's actually a really exciting time and it's a content-rich environment. But COVID was a real wake-up call for everyone because they were forced to look at how the government is and what's going on.
I think it was a wake-up call for a lot of people. I mean, a lot of the other social justice taboos and the atmosphere of cancel culture, I think, alienated a lot of people. I mean, you mentioned straws, but, you know, there were a lot of things about, like, diversity and representation and transgender pronouns and, like, you know, gay pride or Mardi Gras or, like, whatever.
Mm.
That there was certainly an atmosphere at that time that you were coming up of hostility to other voices who disagreed with what the elite consensus was supposed to be. One big area of elite consensus has been on immigration, which seems to be, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, would that be the main focus? I mean, I've
right
listened
now,
to
yeah.
a bit of your content, and it strikes me that you can sort of break your mission up into a few chunks. Maybe immigration is one, and national identity and education and sort of pride, and it might be another, and then there might be the economy as another one. But it strikes me that a lot flows from immigration in terms of whether or not taxpayers are getting a fair shake, in terms of the amount of resources that migrants take, the burden on the NDIS, which is the disability insurance scheme, you know, the social and cultural cohesion of the country in terms of the multicultural project. Where are you on immigration?
Yeah, look, it's become a big issue, not just because of, you know, we're political animals and we look at this stuff. But no, the voters are saying this is one of our biggest issues right now as well as the economy and the cost of living and everything. Immigration to me, as someone whose grandfather came in the late 60s to this country, we left our bag of goods at the door.
Where did he come from?
He came from Lebanon. I do believe it was a French-speaking colony at the time. But Lebanon was a country that basically it's Christian, it speaks English, French, Arabic, and it's quite compatible with Australia when you're importing those sorts of people, which is why very similar to the Greeks, very similar to the Italians, and that's why we tend to get on so well. When we see other people not doing that, not learning the national anthem, the language, the culture, not respecting the flag, it's insulting to us because we're kind of like an adopted son And then the new adopted sons come in and he's not paying his taxes to the household. He's not actually respecting the household. In some cases, they're being violent. They're getting caught up in sexual assaults. This is alarm bells to someone like us.
And who are the they? Who are the new migrants who aren't behaving?
Yeah, look, we get the Sudanese sword fighting in Victoria. We've got a lot of Middle Eastern crimes for the more recent Middle Easterners that are coming out. And obviously, more recently, we're having to deal with radical Islamic terrorism, preachers just thinking that they can just talk the way that they talk and not get locked up, not get deported. I mean, this to us is sending alarm bells because this will threaten a backlash from Australians that are white. And who do you think they're coming for? The NSN guys, the Nazis in this country, they want to deport me too, Josh. Like, I'm not safe from this. And so when I see this instability, this threat to our democracy, I'm like trying to ring a bell here and say, hey, it's not all immigrants. But we've got
is that not sort of a phenomenon that always happens, that the recent migrants want to draw up the drawbridge after they get to a place and demonize the newer people? Because, I mean, you were saying that, like, the Lebanese, like the Greeks and Italians, have integrated well. But because the Lebanese are largely a more recent migrant population than the Greeks and the Italians in Australia, they did have teething problems initially. I mean, 20 years ago, there were riots in Cronulla where,
Let's be specific. The Cronulla riots were a result of Muslims going to that area. And they were sexually assaulting women. And they ended up, it all amalgamated to this point where they beat up some Aussie lifeguards. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of Aussies at the time, they can't tell the difference between basically a Christian Lebanese person or a radical Muslim Middle East person. And that's where the lack of communication can come in. And so that's why I think a lot of immigrants are like looking at the last 20 years. Again, my grandfather came in the late 60s. I mean, how long do you have to be here before, you know, you're considered basically an Australian that's integrated? My dad studied at the Conservatorium of Music. He played the saxophone, the clarinet. He helped build churches in Sydney. His funeral service was in one that he built in Western Sydney, St. Mary's. And so did my grandfather. He helped build Our Lady of Lebanon, the biggest Lebanese Christian church in Western Sydney. When he came out, they were laying the foundations. These are people that are a part of the fabric of Australia. We can't change that. So when they look at the last 20 years, it's not about not including these people. It's that we had to integrate. We had to adopt this. I don't actually speak as much Arabic as I would like, for example. It's not a problem to speak another language, but you have to at least speak English in this country, or at least your kids be learning to speak English in this country. And I think that
is it not the case? I mean, I genuinely don't know that the children of most migrants are speaking English. I mean, they go to schools presumably where they speak English. I know there are a lot of schools where they're only speaking Arabic in Australia.
No, there's not many. But if you look at what's going on with the voting data, for example, I was pulled up on this recently. The worst voting data in Australia right now, I think it's about 25-30% in some electorates, especially local electorates in Western Sydney. Their ballots are getting stuffed up, and it's not because they don't like the system or whatever. They actually don't know how to complete the ballots.
Right. Now, because they haven't learned to read English, you mean?
Exactly. And Josh, we've got to look at this.
Aren't there multiple languages there? Don't they have an Arabic one and like a
it's still
a
bad.
Cantonese one it, and
still,
a Mandarin
it's
one?
It's still that bad. But this is the problem, Josh. We've got immigrants that have come into this country. They have integrated and they have done this. It's the rate at which it's changed. We're now 32% foreign-born. We're now 52% foreign-born or the children of immigrants. This is one of the highest in the world.
Mm.
I mean, it's too fast. It's not about the old immigrants now saying the new immigrants were going to pull up the drawbridge. It's too fast. And
right. We
see it. I mean, you go to Sydney, the QVB, you walk out and it's like a game of spot the white guy.
That's a huge shopping mall in downtown Sydney, just for people who don't know what the QVB, the Queen Victoria building is.
The suburban areas are very much becoming completely different. And look, it wouldn't be scary to a lot of people in Australia that are voting for some of these nationalist parties like One Nation if it wasn't for the fact that if you can't connect with someone, when I hear, for example, the Aussie accent, it means to me immediate trust. It means that this person, maybe they played cricket, maybe they played rugby, but we have a shared social fabric. And so I'm not saying everyone has to have the Aussie accent. But
no, I mean, your grandfather didn't when he got here.
Absolutely
not. My father didn't when he got here.
Absolutely not. But you look at his kids and his grandkids and you're like, oh, okay. Like,
well, we haven't had time to look at the grandkids of the people who arrived within the past 20 years.
Right. Let's take another example. My bishop is Bishop Mara Murray. He was stabbed in the eye. Who did it? Who did it? It was a bunch of Muslim teens that were born here. They didn't integrate. They ended up getting radicalized. And they went and actually not only stabbed him in the eye and wanted to kill him, but they then had a whole bunch of synagogues they were going to hit up with weapons they had. This was completely undercovered by the media.
I remember this. And he was preaching at the time, right?
He was.
They
just
stormed into a church.
Exactly. And what happened after that? The Christian Middle Easterners had an immediate trauma to what they've experienced in the Middle East. I've got relatives that have been burned in cages by ISIS in 2015, 2016. This is the immediate trauma we have, and we understand that threat. I think that the problem with a lot of Aussies is they don't recognize that if you import the third world too quickly, you'll import the problems as well. There's got to be a slow, teething issue of becoming an Australian.
Mm.
And that's the real threat. And that's why when Bondi happened, I think we were all a bit traumatized by it. First, the biggest shooting in 30 years, Muslim terrorists that were radicalized potentially by ISIS went to the Philippines. The investigation's still ongoing, obviously, but this was a huge wake-up call for this country. And I think that we've got to really wake up from it.
I think you're right that secular people don't understand what they're talking about, because I honestly think secular people don't understand what it's like to be deeply religious.
Mm.
Like I think, and I didn't either. I think secular people think that religious people don't really believe the things that they pretend to believe, because nobody could believe such silly things. No offense.
No, I understand.
But
where you're
coming
from,
that actually, if you really believe that the creator of the universe wrote a book, that changes where your priorities are and what you're willing to do, at his behest. And until we kind of reckon with the sincerity of that mission among some new arrivals, we're going to have a blind spot about what it takes to integrate, because we think that it's just going to be about playing cricket or, you know, going to the same places to eat food. And actually, there is a deeper challenge about maintaining the fabric of a multicultural society when you add in the dose of extreme religious belief. But that, I guess, brings us to your religious belief as well. What role does Christianity play in your worldview and Turning Point Australia's mission?
It's entirely formative. Christianity is about being Christ-like. It is about trying to emulate how he was amazing. I mean, the fruit of the Spirit as a Christian is love, peace, patience, forbearance, kindness. These are values we should all be trying to emulate. And these are the founding principle of what made the West great, what made Australia great. And these are great values to teach your kids, whether you're religious or not. Anyone that is coming here and preaching in any institution or a mosque and saying anything that's incitement, anything that's demonizing a specific class, it's a huge issue. And the idea that we're not going to check that by cancelling these people's visas or deporting them from the country, we're asking for it. We are absolutely asking for it. And so,
and how do you balance that with free speech? I mean, I wrestle with this myself, that like, I don't believe in outlawing ideas. I don't think that it should be a crime to say globalize the intifada, even though I think it's a totally stupid and violent thing to say.
I agree.
And so I'm a bit conflicted. Like, when you suppose you know, there are a few imams in Australia who are well known to ASIO, our intelligence agencies, and just to anyone who's plugged in, to be extremely regressive, sexist, gay-hating, Jew-hating, anti-Western, virulently anti-American, virulently anti-Israel people who seem to take pride in recruiting young Muslims into a much more theological and theocratic worldview than most Australians would be comfortable with. These people are not Australian citizens necessarily, but if you kick them out, aren't you just opening the door to exactly the kind of nanny state that you're objecting to with COVID?
No, we have existing laws in the books. If I said anything that these men said, I would have landed in a cell straight away. That it's as simple as that. When I gave my speech on town hall steps, I saw what the state could do when it wants to do something. It would stretch laws to get me, get other people. The guy behind Oz versus the Agenda, which is a big channel in Australia, I saw what they did to that guy. I saw how they tracked his phone with the existing laws in the books.
I don't know that that case. Is that another nationalist right-wing outlet?
Yes. That's right. And he was one of the protest organizers, and I saw how efficient the state could be with him. So when I look at what's going on with the Bondi shooting and the aftermath and the ongoing investigation, one thing that no one in the parties are really saying except One Nation, the Nationalist Party, is you had existing laws on the books. We passed them back when we had a previous terrorist attack in Martin Place. Why didn't you use those? Why do you have to pass new laws? And that's the real question, because I totally agree with you. I don't think we need speech laws. I think we need more speech. I don't agree with banning the NSN if they're not inciting violence. And the biggest mistake of all, these guys wanted to run in elections. They wanted to run.
Are you talking about the NSN? That's the neo-Nazi party?
They wanted to run in the elections in Victoria.
They wanted. They still do, I think. I mean, I think they will.
They can't. They can't now. They wrapped up their organization, White Australia. That was an opportunity for people like you and I, public-facing figures, to not only criticize their bad ideas, but also to see them run and see them lose to the democratic process that we have in this country. The moment you deny that to them, that is pushing them underground, pushing their ideas to be unopposed. And now we're in a situation where we don't know where they are. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know what they're planning next.
So doesn't that argue for allowing the imam to stay here and monitor him and make sure that his congregants are not violent rather than kicking him out of the country and pushing the problem underground?
My view is that they, if there's someone that's broken our existing laws in this country and they're not a Australian citizen, they should be deported. It's as simple as that. I think we've gone soft. I think we really need to be serious about this, because the law was very clear on some of these imams and how they've broken it. And some of these laws are being wielded against right-wingers in Australia right now that did far less things. And so this is a real question in my mind about why we needed new laws when the laws were already there, but also the fact that they're being wielded but not against the people perhaps that they should have been wielded on that did break the law. Mm. And so there's a huge accountability problem, and that's why the polling recently is the way it is for this.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, isn't it, the problem of consistency in the application of laws. Like, I mean, I was taking a piss at a urinal the other day, and there was graffiti saying it was like "die Jew scum" or something like that on the, someone had scrawled on the tile. And I thought, it is interesting that we live in a moment where I don't actually know if that person is far right or far left. Like that, because I was in a pretty bohemian, like lefty part of Sydney. I was in the inner west. And so I was like, it's probably unlikely that person is a neo-Nazi. That person is probably, you know, an Islamist sympathizer, probably a non-Muslim, like lefty. But if you said that thing in public, and the authorities coded you as Nazi-affiliated, they'd throw the book at you. But if you said that thing in public and the authorities coded you as a progressive, well-meaning, like Greens Party person, it's no one can deny that the punishment would be more moderate.
That's right.
If at all.
And that's what's astonishing. It's the shoehorn theory. The idea that the horseshoe is the two spots at the end are really close together the further you go right or left. But it is radical Islam. It is the far right Nazis, and it is the far left. I appreciate sitting with you as a Jewish person and sort of trying, you can see where this is going. This is not good stuff. And look, whether you're Jewish or not, it's irrelevant to me. You're an Australian, and it's not good that we have 15 people getting gunned down on Bondi. It's not good. And the idea that one of them was 23 years old, he's still alive, and he's someone that was born here, tells you how long this has been coming and how long this has been baking. We have had consecutive failures by conservative governments and Labor governments. We've had consecutive failures. And so this is our comeuppance from bad governance. And we need to have a correction. We need to have a turning point.
Christianity, though, it seems to me like a bad fit for a multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious, modern state. What does the nationalism in the Christian nationalism? Because culturally, I understand the value of learning about the history on which Western civilization is based, the ethos of Jesus, just like the ethos of Moses or Muhammad or whoever. I mean, these are all things that have influenced our lives and influenced our intellectual histories, and it's worth being aware of. But privileging one over the other in the 21st century feels regressive, myopic, superstitious.
Sure. Look, we're a Christian nation.
What does that mean?
Well, Christianity is not a white religion. It is literally a Middle Eastern religion.
But what does "we are a Christian nation" mean? I mean, I don't think a majority of I know that a majority of Australians don't go to church each week.
Yeah, but when it was founded, the democratic principles that came about and the morals which informed them, where else were you going to get your morals from when it was founded? It was Christians that founded it. And so
it was at a time when the percolating ideas of the French Revolution and the American Revolution were extremely secular. Like, they were in opposition to religious domination of the state. They were all about separating the church and state. Now, at the time, Darwin didn't exist yet. Being an atheist wasn't viable.
Yeah.
So, and everyone was a Christian, so obviously they were Christians who were doing it. But they weren't motivated by Christian theology when they were designing the separation of powers.
No, of course they were. Look, and Dr. Stephen Shavira, you've got to talk to Dr. Stephen Shavira. He's a professor in Australia. He's someone that teaches at Campion College. And he argues that actually, if you look at the word secular when the Constitution was written, it doesn't mean what we mean today, secular. That word has changed over time. Secular never meant that you keep religion out of politics. It's actually, where else do you get your morals from? It's actually Christianity.
I'm sure he has a fancy theory about that. But I mean, the First Amendment of the US, Constitution. Like, I mean, the Bill of Rights, rather. The idea that you should have freedom of speech and religion, meaning freedom from government articulation of a state religion, is foundational to the American experiment and bled into the thinking of the Australian founders.
Sure. Look, Josh, the Australia is changing, and so you're in a very strong position with the new demographic to argue we need a new system. However, the point still stands, when you have such a diversity of people and cultures, when we used to have a dominant Australian culture and now we've got a bunch of supposedly equal subcultures, and not every culture is equal, the system we have now is not fit. And that's why we're coming to an impasse. So I actually agree with you. The demographics have changed so much that the democratic system we have now, it's not fit for purpose. It was made for a time where we were homogenous.
I mean, I don't think that. I think you probably fall further outside of, you probably have more disdain for the system than I do. And I am frustrated with the system because I feel like, quite recently, meaning in the last couple of decades, we have lost the ability to confidently articulate what being Australian is all about and what democracy is all about and what liberalism is all about, what pluralism should be and what multiculturalism can be. And we've become cowed because we feel like we have to never offend anybody, which means that we have no sort of ground to stand on. But I think that I believe that that ground can be found within the secular democratic process. And maybe you believe it requires a theological underpinning. Otherwise, there's nothing to tether it to.
Absolutely. It's a void. And the problem is, this has come about due to atheism. It's come out about due to this secularism that you're speaking of. I believe that because this void's opened up and because we've demonized our past, and what's ended up happening is it's opened up this huge void where anything can fill it. So if you want to see what our future looks like, my friend, go and look at what's going on in the UK. They don't have state governments. They have local, and then they have national government. And at a local level, they are enforcing Sharia law at a local level because these areas are majority Muslim. And if you want that, great. That's phenomenal. You can, you know, that's what we're going to see in Australia very soon if we don't bring immigration under control. But what we're seeing over there is these courts. We're seeing mass Pakistani rape gangs. We're seeing police that aren't going after these things. And that's not something I want, man. I'm like, well, we've got to come with our own bag of goods. I've always been a Christian. It's something in the past I might have parked more and been more private about, but I'm recognizing that, hey, if we're not more overt about it, this will fill the void. And so I love where the intellectual dark web came from. I love that mentality of being like, we're progressive in that sense. But it's not going to work in my view. I respect the view and I understand it, but I just don't think it's going to work. I think it's going to destroy Australian society and everything we love.
What will exactly?
The void that's been created. I think that the idea...
The void of values or a void of what?
The void of basically demonizing Christianity, the void of demonizing the values that made Australia great in the first place. I think that by demonizing these things and not replacing it with something that is amicable, because they never replaced it. They only brought it down. I think that when you mass, immigrate people from the world, whether it's refugees or whatever, if it's too quick, these people are certain of what they believe in. In fact, they're prepared to die for it. That is the problem when it's too quick. And so we don't exactly have churches set up for secularism in Australia. We're not exactly evangelical about that. In fact, people that are secular tend to not actually have many kids. So,
don't you think it would be an easier task of persuasion to say to new arrivals who might be quite dogmatic in their religious beliefs, we don't have a religion that we're going to impose on you. All you have to do is agree with the basic principles of this country, which are that you treat everybody equally, that men aren't any better than women, that straight people aren't any better than gay people, that we live and let live, that you don't bring violence here, that you don't have enmity towards other ethnic and religious groups.
Yep.
That strikes me as an easier sell.
Josh, I agree with you, but they're not
doing
that.
Your plan of like, we are a Christian nation and you have to convert, presumably, or like there's...
Yeah, look, I'm not saying that. No, look, I'm not saying that at all. I think that, where there's risk, there must be choice with this stuff. I'm a libertarian with that stuff and I believe that our ideas will live out. Unfortunately, we're not able to do that. We are being persecuted. You've just got to talk to people like Kiralee Smith or Lyle Sheldon. They've got like half a dozen court cases each with the woke state going after them, the LGBT Nazis going after them. But what you're saying makes perfect sense.
And just to pause on that, who's going after them for what?
So stuff like they often challenge and get challenged by their comments about transgender men serving and playing sports in women's sports, for example.
Transgender women meaning biological.
Biological men jumping into women's
women,
sports,
yeah.
That sort of stuff. But also, I mean, their comments online saying that, look, transition can be harmful, talking about these sorts of topics is a highly litigious issue. And those are very interesting people with stories around each one of them. And the courts and these groups, they're getting run through the courts in a big way. But let's where I was going was you've talked about properly policing our values, secular or not, or Christian or not, of people coming to the country. Mate, that makes perfect sense, but that's not what's happening right now. And I totally agree. Equality between the sexes, equality before the law, actually paying your taxes to the government. A lot of these values that you get asked in when you come to this country, we don't do the vetting like we used to. When my grandfather came out, he was heavily vetted, heavily. How is his language? Did he have compatible ideology with regards to Australia? Basic stuff. It's not happening. And that's why we're ringing the bells on this. It's not a hatred of foreigners. I am a foreigner by genetics. It's ringing the alarm bells and saying, hey, the guys that shot up Bondi, the father didn't actually, back in the late 90s, he didn't actually conform with Australian values. And not only was he on the ACO watch list, not only was he someone in their crosshairs, but they then didn't do anything on him and he was allowed to get a gun. That's where the existing laws...
He was allowed to get multiple guns travel to a terrorist hotspot in the southern Philippines and return without... Yeah, I mean, that's an obvious intelligence failure, which I suppose we could go into. Where do you see American... You mentioned the UK, obviously, and it looks like the UK could have a turning point style leader after the election.
Yeah, Nigel.
In your mate, Nigel.
Can I just say, he's a great guy. Like, I spent a lot of time I made the mistake of trying to outdrink him when he was in Australia. Yeah. He's a great guy.
He looks
guy.
Like he's had a pint or two in his life.
Yeah, he had. But what you see, he is that guy. Like, he's a larger than life figure. And I'm not just saying that. He'll never see this podcast. But that man, he's like, there are people in America that genuinely don't impress me, that are higher profile than Nigel. Nigel, as an individual, as someone that can articulate his issues, is genuinely impressive. I really like that man, and he's a huge role model, I guess you could say.
What about the States? I mean, what do you make of Turning Point in the States at the moment? I mean, Erica Kirk, JD Vance, she's endorsed him.
Mm.
Some people are like, oh, they're having an affair.
Look, I don't follow the ins and outs of the American politics. I genuinely am Australia first. I'm focused on honoring Charlie and his vision in Australia. With a lot of the stuff in America, it would be unwise for me to comment on, the American organization there, because frankly, it doesn't concern what we're doing here. We're still growing here. We're living out our mission. The one question that goes through my mind, though, is I don't understand why Erica hasn't sued some of these people, like Candace Owens. I genuinely don't understand why that hasn't happened.
No, she's probably smart enough that she knows if you wrestle with a pig, you just get.
Yeah,
you both get dirty.
Sure.
Who do you like politically in the States? You mentioned Farage in the context of the UK.
Yeah,
not speaking on behalf of Turning Point now, but just as a person, are you a JD-er? Do you want Tucker to run? Who's the heir to MAGA?
Mate, I don't know. I think that we've got to see a lot more. The next election's 2028. Primaries will start to begin in 2027. I am not impressed by the current options on the table. I think that JD Vance, whilst he has some promising things, there's some huge questions around those that got him there, the Peter Thiels of the world, the surveillance state that's coming. I do worry about some of the anti-Semitism laws he's pushing over there. I don't support them here. I don't support them there. Because if that happens and we have the Twitters of the world and other social media channels based out of there and organizations, that's going to affect us. So, I'm in two minds. Whilst it doesn't affect us, it does affect us. Mm. And we should have a bit of a voice our opinions on it. I'm not impressed by those on offer. I'm very eager to see who puts their hand up. I would like to see someone put their hand up that's a bit more American first. I really don't think that.
What does that mean?
I think putting America's interests first is
better. JD Vance doesn't?
I don't think so. I don't think so to an extent.
Just help me understand what the daylight is between what you think America First is and what he does.
Yeah, look, his policy is currently the Trump policy. So to be clear, we're talking about the Trump administration. The anti-Semitism laws that have not been opposed by the Trump administration is a huge issue.
Which are what?
Which are basically, it's very similar to what we have, what they were passing here, which is you can't, they've lumped in anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. That's, last I checked, you're not a Zionist, right?
No, I mean, I certainly don't think that anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism are the same thing. And I certainly don't think that people should be denounced or let alone prosecuted for airing criticisms of Israel. I never would have historically called myself a Zionist, but since October 7th, and I think the nature of the rhetoric, it's become a term that I think is less helpful than to define oneself as not a Zionist is almost as unhelpful to me as defining oneself as a Zionist. I am a Zionist to the extent that I think that it's inconsistent for most anti-Zionists to oppose the right of Jewish people to have a state when they don't oppose the right of South Asian Muslims to have a state in Pakistan or Arab Muslims to have a state in Saudi Arabia or Japanese people to have a state in Japan. Like if they universally objected to any states having an ethnic complexion to them, then I'd be fine. And in my ideal worldview, we wouldn't need Zionism. We would all just get along, but given the state of the world, I regard myself as a Zionist to the extent that I think that there's nothing illegitimate about Jewish people coordinating into a state.
So let's change it up a bit. The idea that laws are being passed in America, for example, let's say if it was for China, you can't criticize China.
Mm.
Significant problem.
Yeah.
And so what's happened is we've lumped it in, and I respect the fact that a lot of anti-Semites, rabid anti-Semites. They lump in their criticism and they hide their criticism of Jewish people by criticizing Israel. I respect that fact. But they've gone too far now. They've gone too far in passing these laws where you can't criticize this foreign country and their actions.
So in other words, when you say that it's not the Trump-Vance administration is not sufficiently America first, you're saying it's not sufficiently libertarian?
I mean, do they have free speech or not? Charlie Kirk was very clear about this. He opposed Pam Bondi. He called her out. I don't support these speech laws. He believed in basically hitting the pavement, going to universities, having it out.
Mm.
That's how we changed hearts and minds. He opposed these laws, the ones that were put up in Florida. He opposed them. Now, last I checked, I don't think J.D. Vance opposes that. I believe he supports these laws.
I mean, to be honest, I don't think that J.D. Vance will ever be president, even if he is the nominee, because I think there's a sprinkle of pixie dust in Trump that I don't find particularly appealing, but that is able to hold together quite a disparate coalition of different people with different concerns, from, you know, laid off Appalachian workers to the tech bros in Silicon Valley to, you know, dudes in the Midwest who are, you know, salt of the earth guys or whatever. And you're going to need someone to hold that coalition together.
Mm.
I think it will be a Tucker Carlson or someone like that.
Oh, you think? I don't think he'll run.
I think if he gets to the point at which he doesn't think that that Trumpism is going to survive Trump with anyone else, I could see him doing it, because I think he's quite self-aggrandizing and loves the spotlight.
We're going to be covering this very deep. in a year from now, talking, you know, February 2027, we're going to have a lot more individuals that put their hand up. I'm very excited for that debate. I think it's going to be one of the most robust since 2016.
Yeah.
I think it'll be fascinating. Yeah.
I mean, this is one of the things that I worry about with your movement and with the sort of new right in Australia, which is that the UK and the US are so big in their output culturally. Obviously, the US is larger, but we have a historical relationship with Britain that makes it larger than, which has it punching above its weight in terms of what Australians focus on. And especially in an age of social media, so a lot of our content is coming out of those markets. That I wonder whether part of our conversations here actually get contaminated by things that are going on over there. So that a lot of the outrage over the excesses of wokeness are partly fueled by American wokeness, which has been more intense, I think, than anywhere else. And part of our worries about immigration are partly based on what you're talking about in the UK, where there has been dramatically uncontrolled immigration and very poor integration of some communities in a way that doesn't exist here. And so I wonder how much of your worldview do you think would be the same if you were put in an isolated chamber and only focused on Australian, on the Australian context?
Yeah.
And how much of you maybe swayed a little bit further outside of the mainstream than you would be were it not for the fact that you've got all these American and British inputs pinging off your brain all the time?
Well, I mean, you just raised a great point. Let's measure apples for apples here. Turning Point USA supports J.D. Vance. They've just come out and I've just said to you that I've got to see more from him before I think he's the guy. So, I mean, straight away, I've just showed you apples for apples, the head of that organization, the head of this organization. We don't see eye to eye on that. Now, again, it's a long way off. If I was in their shoes, I wouldn't be picking a winner and a loser this early on. Who knows who could come out of the woodworks in a country of 330 million people in the next year and a half.
No, but I mean, you get the substance of my question. It's not about who should be the next president. It's about whether or not... You know, immigration, national values, Christian nationalism, the threat of jihadism, education, social justice. Are these things natively Australian problems to the extent that you, like, do they warrant the extent of your focus in a purely Australian context?
Well, we've got similar problems. Now, look, I'm loyal to my values. I'm a Christian. I'm a conservative. I want smaller government, less rules. And I also, I look at the issues we face because of COVID with mass expenditure. We've got to bring that under control. That's also an American issue. They had a mass illegal immigration problem. We don't have that so much. But I think there's about 100,000 or so which we could deport that have overstayed their visas, for example. But that's not exactly illegal immigration that are pushing drugs and, you know.
Yeah, I hear that number. I think the number is slightly lower. I heard 60 to 70. But to be clear,
it's a legal problem. That's my point.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it is very different from the American scenario because, as you say, they're not people who have come here in order to illegally in order to work and live here illegally and then cross back and forth over a porous border to essentially live here in the shadows. Yeah. These are people who came in here legally and they stayed a few months too long on a student visa or
a tourist visa. But the point is there's similar motifs. The idea that there's a underlying sense of draining the swamp, draining the billabong in Australia's case. we do have one of the most bloated bureaucratic groups in the world in Australia in government. They are disproportionately paid higher. They think completely differently. They're the only place that voted for the Voice referendum, which really articulated.
Oh, that's interesting. Is that true? Is it public servants voted?
No.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, in the ACT being.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right.
In the ACT.
So the territory. So in order to get a referendum passed, you need a majority of voters in a majority of states and none of the states voted majority.
Yep.
But the tiny territory that surrounds the Australian capital, which Americans can think of a bit like the District of Columbia where Washington, D.C. is, that was the only state or territory that voted in favour of the indigenous body.
Right. And look, America has a binary vote every 4 years, basically. They have Democrat or Republican. 80% of Washington, D.C. votes. For the Democrats. In Australia, in our capital territory of the ACT, they had 70% of the state vote for. So they're very similar like that. So we do have similar problems. We have a lot of wastage. The idea that we spend billions on, for example, Aboriginal issues, but that's not really getting to the grassroots. A lot of Aboriginal campaigners are saying, hey, you're saying you're spending this stuff, but who's it going to? Bureaucrats, lawyers, planners? We're not seeing that hit the actual 20% of Aboriginals in rural areas. And I think that's partly why the Northern Territory voted against The Voice too, which is obviously heavily Aboriginal. So, Josh, there's a huge reckoning that's coming for accountability in this country. It is a reoccurring motif in America. But I can assure you, look, everything that guides my actions in this country, it is about being loyal to my values. And the moment that splits with the US turning point or even the MAGA movement in the USA, I'll call it out. I mean, I can be very flexible with the political party loyalties, but I'm very unflexible on these values. I think they're fundamental.
One of the worries about playing this game is that you need to sort of have the solutions as well. And the reason I'm conflicted about you and your movement is just that I think you talk about a lot of valid problems. But there is a recurring bait and switch which happens in democracies, and we've seen it time and again, where people appeal to the population on the basis of problems that are, widely felt and inadequately addressed by elites and governments, and then ride a populist wave of power to ultimately demonstrate that they were kind of disingenuous and there aren't actually fixes that are very easy to these things. So, I mean, for me, Brexit is a good example. I'm sure you're in favour of Brexit, but, Boris Johnson goes around the country saying, why are we spending $350 million a week on the EU, sending it to Brussels when we could be funding the NHS? Mm-hmm. Well, that figure doesn't take into account the rebates that Brussels sends back to the UK, so it's actually about 30% less than what he was saying anyway. And it doesn't account for the fact that I actually looked up the latest on Brexit just because this was front of mind for another reason. So the UK's GDP is 6 to 8% lower today than if they'd been stayed in the EU. Mm-hmm. Investment has dropped by 12 to 18%. Productivity is down 3 or 4%. Trade volumes have fallen. The average household is estimated to be about £2,000 worse off, so $3,000 or $4,000 in dollars worse off. So there's been slower growth, less investment, and more barriers to trade and labour. So that $350 million that could be going to the NHS is more than it just evaporates in the context of the lower tax receipts. Now Britain is in dire economic straits.
Yeah.
It's not been nearly as easy as they promised to negotiate trade agreements. They can't have free trade with the EU because they've got Northern Ireland and Ireland. Like, so you've got these big complicated things that pointy-headed, like, eggheads have been working on for a long time. Like, and someone comes along and says, "Oi, you know, why are they bossing you around? What about our national sovereignty? let's the little man stand up again. Let's not send all our money." And it's an easy punchline.
Yeah.
But then you get it done and you realize, actually, shit, this is complicated. And you spend years arguing over all this arcane bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, Trump comes in on a, like, drain the swamp. You just said drain the swamp. He's running one of the most corrupt administrations. Just shamelessly, you know, he puts a tariff on Vietnam and, you know, all of a sudden the next week, the Vietnamese pay him a bunch of money and the tariff is lifted. He puts one on Switzerland and they give him a gold bar and the tariff is lifted. Like,
yeah, imperialism.
Extraordinary stuff.
No, you raise a great
stuff.
Point.
Like,
yeah.
So
let's speak about Brexit.
Yeah, what's the end? The practical end game?
I totally agree. And Nigel Farage would agree with you too about Brexit, specifically Brexit. It was a push to actually be the lord of your own sovereignty. 70% of their laws were being created in a place that was not the UK, in the EU. And it's a bit like when you win the lottery. You might win the lottery, but are you going to hold, if we check up on you in a year, you're still going to have that money. What he won them was the lottery in actually taking back control. Now, the Conservative government that was in under Boris Johnson and others, they totally botched it. They didn't use it. That's why Farage is back. He came out of retirement in mid-2024. He says, you know what? And I can promise you this. He did not want to go back into politics. This is a guy who campaigned for 25 years. The guy wanted to go. He's getting close to retirement.
Oh, come on.
No, he did.
Say what you want about Nigel. Mate, he is a media darling. He loves that. You don't get
there's a difference.
And a camera.
Yeah, but to be a political party leader is very different to being on GB News where he was happy making money.
He'll be happy being Prime Minister.
You don't know this. But
he'll be happy in number 10.
Nigel was this close to moving to Australia. He had a regular segment on Sky News. He had the GB News things coming up. He wasn't going that direction. So in the middle of the campaign in 2024 in July, when he basically, I remember seeing it at the time, he made that decision, you know what, there's literally no one that's going to be able to do this and to actually breathe Brexit and the benefits of it. That's why I totally agree with you. Boris Johnson totally botched the implementation of Brexit and actually playing it out. They never wanted it to start with. When it was voted for, 3/4 of the parliament didn't actually support Brexit. Mm. And so how can we trust them to even enact it? Of course they didn't. And that's why I bring up the lotto analogy, the idea that someone wins the lotto and then doesn't know how to use it. Of course it's going to evaporate when you check up on them in a year. And so getting sovereignty also relies on having great leadership. And Brexit highlighted the fact that it took them 10 years to implement it. They fought against the people. And 52% of the country voted for Brexit. They wanted it. And the government begrudgingly implemented it after 10 years. And they tried to...
That's because shit's complicated.
Of course it's complicated, but this is what people voted for. And the idea that Nigel has come back out of his retirement to actually do frontline politics again is him being accountable and saying, I will come back, I will do this. And I am very interested to have another discussion with you after the guy presumably becomes prime minister and say, all right, what are you going to do with it? In the next 100 days, 1 year, 4 years, 5 years, he might run again, who knows? And say, what did you actually do with Brexit? You campaigned for 25 years to get this. You came back to frontline politics. What did you end up doing with it? That is the real test of this.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It'll be interesting to see what he delivers if he does become prime minister. But, I mean, what do you want? What are the main policy changes that you would make in Australia that you would advocate?
Well, let's be specific. If you ask me any element of policy in Australia, the most thorough policy outlook and detail I've seen is from One Nation, which is what I agree with. I don't agree with everything in it. Obviously, there's some things on economics I might be like.
And what is their platform? Because I think most Australians just think of One Nation and they think, oh, it's a bit of a joke. It's a former fish and chip shop owner from, you know, the suburbs of Queensland who started a political party because she didn't like Asian people in the 1990s. And, you know, now it's just an anti-immigration party. But what is it that
yeah,
they advocate?
Look, immigration aside, because in short, they want to reduce it down to 100,000 legal immigration. They don't want to see what we're seeing, which is half a million every year.
Not every year, but it peaked at half a million a couple of years ago.
Because of the COVID lull. But no, in terms of economics, for example, things like income splitting, the idea that a couple can income split and actually not get taxed at a higher rate. Why are we punishing families in starting a family together and getting couples going? Talking about construction, talking about how we're actually going to get the trades in this country that we have here, actually policing immigration that comes in with skills, we're not following up with people that come in under the guise of being construction workers. I mean, less than 0.5% of the immigration that comes into this country is from that construction industry. The idea, the lie, we need mass immigration for that. Yes, we do, but that's not what's coming in. You're not properly policing that.
Are you saying that people come in on construction visas and then go and work in another field?
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. They go for other things.
I mean, this happens in student visas, and I mean, there are huge loopholes where people come in on one visa and then...
Yeah, I've seen these schools. They come in. I've got a number of these schools or academies near where I work. And these guys, they come in their fluoro vests. They've got no shame. They're not meant to be working on these student visas. Mm. They come in, they do their 30 minutes, they leave, and they go and work. You're not allowed to be doing that. Two, that's probably not being taxed, the work they're doing. Mm. And three, they are putting a strain on the infrastructure. And we're, as a country, we are carrying that. And unfortunately, I agree, we do need immigration for skills that we're short on. But it's got to be short and sharp. You're coming in to build this infrastructure project. We know you've got this. We want to see that, yes, you do have a contract. The employer has said this guy's employed for 3 years for this train project or whatever, and then go from there. But that's not what's happening. And so One Nation is about accountability. They've earmarked billions of dollars to be cut, which isn't being efficiently spent in government expenditure, so we can bring the debt down. They do have great economic policies with regards to taxes that help families. They have some great housing issues, which is a massive one, and also supporting farmers, supporting our supply chain so that we can bring down the cost of food and everything. They've got a very thorough policy on their website. And in fact, I think they did actually set up an AI which can actually outlay to you in a 2-hour podcast their full policy, technology is amazing. I mean, we're going to be out of work soon.
I mean, the things we can do with our spare time.
Yeah.
We can now listen to an artificial intelligence summarize the One Nation policy for us. I'll be spending my evening.
But hey, you asked for it. When I get frustrated with the Conservative Party in Australia, the Liberals, the so-called Conservatives, there's so little detail, Josh. There's so little detail on what they stand for. And they're meant to be the economic managers. And they try to have it every way. That's why they don't put as much detail. Whereas with One Nation, with Nigel Farage, with Trump, you know what you're getting. They're coming in. They're bringing in this.
Well, I'm not sure you do know. I don't think you. I mean, maybe with One Nation, but I don't think Americans knew what they were getting when they voted for Donald Trump. I don't think they were resoundingly voting for Minneapolis to happen or for, Greenland to happen. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, well, we've got to be specific. What the guy did run on, it was government accountability. It was draining the swamp. It was the idea that he was going to put an end to the border crossings.
Do you think he's delivered on draining the swamp? No, on accountability?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, look at the Epstein files. I called this out in July last year, and this is just another example of how I'm loyal to my values. Contrary to my audience, I called Trump out at the time because you can't get captured by your audience. You can't get captured by your audience. I see it happen all the time. I called him out. I said, hey, you're now gaslighting people and saying these files don't exist and no list exists of Epstein's clients. There is a list. And now we see it with the 3 million documents that came out. But why did he do that in the first place? So I totally agree. I'm loyal to my values on this. The idea that we've got these people running around that are above the law for business or for what some of the more sexual in nature things that they were doing, it's got to be called out. And he hasn't drained the swamp. If anything, expenditure is way too high over there.
And just on the final, I need to wrap, unfortunately, because we started a little late, and so I wish we could talk for longer, but I just want to do a couple of final questions. Family values, you mentioned. had a really interesting chat with the former Deputy Prime Minister, John Anderson, about gay marriage and family values and the sort of excesses of the LGBTQIA plus like movement and gender ideology and so on versus gay rights. Where does your Christianity and your libertarianism, what's the boundary there? Like, I'm married to a guy. Does my marriage get annulled under a Christian national Australia?
Look, I've got a weird view on this. I actually don't think the government should be involved in that. I think it's more a tax status than anything. If I had it my way, I would never be submitting it to the government or my marriage statuses. Look, if you want to be in a union—
There are some countries that do that. I think Israel doesn't have civil marriage.
Right.
You just get married at a religious place. And if you're not religious, then you are in a de facto relationship.
Yeah, look, it's a deeply spiritual thing with your church. That's always been my view of it. The government getting involved with this stuff, I've never seen it as opportunistic. But I am relatively libertarian on this stuff. I do think that there is a problem, you know, I'd like to think if my bishop was sitting here, I think there is a problem with the nation coming out and saying, yeah, this is on the equal footing as a Christian marriage. I don't think that's right.
Well, the nation didn't say it's on an equal footing as a Christian marriage. The nation just said it's on an equal footing as the civil marriage that the government allows you to.
But let's look at what's happened as a result of that. We've seen massive attacks on Christian institutions, the employment choices they make. We've seen, as I mentioned earlier, Lyle Sheldon and Kirrilly Smith having to fight these battles on these LGBT issues, which have nothing to do with you. I mean, you haven't lost your marbles, and you're not saying that, you know, a biological man that becomes a woman should be able to beat up women in women's sports. I mean, you're not saying that. You haven't lost the thread. And so I don't mind your type, but there are militant ones out there that are using that issue as a mask, as a battering ram to bring down Christian institutions.
Right, but is it, just on the narrow question of gay marriage, is it pro-family or anti-family that I have a spouse and children and a household rather than the previous regime under which I wouldn't have been able to have that?
I think you've got to assess every situation specifically. I didn't know you had kids. I think you've got to assess everything individually. But no, I feel very uncomfortable actually talking on that. Listen, Josh, we agree on a lot of things, but
I'll take that as a no.
But all I can say is, look, if my son was struggling with the gay, I would have huge issues. I would be something. It would be a whole of family effort. Whilst he will always be loved, and whilst all of those things, it's not something where I would say that I'm going to celebrate it. I couldn't do that, and that's just me being loyal to.
Well, you and the jihadists have something in common.
No. Well, I'm not going to throw you off a building if that's what you're wondering. Thank There's you. A big difference there.
The last thing I want to get a sense of is like.
Can I just say one last thing on that? Let's be clear. It's not a hatred of you as a person at all. It is a behavior. Homosexuality is a sin. I sin like all the time. It's something that I work on. It's whether it's, you know, lying, murder, or this or that. Everyone sins. And so it's not about hating gay people, which it should never, that should never be okay. That's
just,
never,
no offense, but that line is not a consolation.
That
line is just a line that gets used by. Like, I don't think you're bigoted about it. You're perfectly entitled to have a religious objection to homosexuality.
Sure.
But trying to split the hair and be like, it's a sin, but you have to love the sinner, it just lands as like clunky and disingenuous.
No, but
because basically, if someone genuinely believes that something is not a sin and they're going to live their whole life as if it's not a sin, then it's not a consolation for a person to come along and say, I believe that you're behaving every single day in a sinful manner without completely shamelessly, but I don't like disrespect you for it because you sort of do and like ought to really. So I mean, that's just,
but like, I'm just saying that
it's not useful.
Yeah. Well, as I said before, I'm loyal to my values on this. I'm not going to bullshit you on this. I'm just saying that if someone came to me on a totally different thing, said, hey, I just cheated on my wife. I'm like, well, I think that's wrong. And that's why I'm giving you the respect of saying and not bullshitting you and saying, I think that's wrong. I don't accept it, but you won't catch me trying to destroy you, trying
I get it.
Lambast you. And I think there's a big difference.
All I'm saying is that
because there are people out there that will do that. And that's why I'm putting my foot down.
Yeah. My case would be more akin to somebody saying, I cheat on my wife every day. I don't think there's anything wrong with people cheating on their wives. I honestly just think that it's completely fine. Like that person it wouldn't be any consolation to be like, don't worry. I mean, I object to the fact that, you know, you do the sin, but I don't really object to you. That's sort of, it sort of feels like splitting hairs.
Sure.
Australia, I think one thing that motivates you might be that you have a negative view of the direction that Australia has been going in the 21st century across the board. I have some faith that the political system as it exists can remedy that if we have the right kinds of conversations. You might have less faith and think that we have to do it somewhat outside the political system. No?
No, not at all.
Like what?
Not at all. I think we've still got our valves.
Have things been getting better or have things been getting worse?
Oh, they've definitely been getting worse. I don't think we're beyond the point of not being able to remedy it through politics. But to be clear, politics is downstream from culture. And that's why I think conversations like this are critical in understanding our fellow Australians. But when it comes to the political system, I do think we can still change things and we should engage in that process. And any talking of trying to do it by some violent revolution is silly. And in Australia's context, it doesn't make sense. And that's why it's important we do protect our democratic institutions, whether it's your coverage of whistleblowers or speaking truth to power. These are critical institutions we need as correction mechanisms so that we can make sure we stay on the straight and narrow as a democracy. And that's why it's so critical that we have conversations like this and build followings online so that we can sort of have hubs where, we hold each other accountable, but also we can better understand each other and less see each other as other and
more certainly. As
like, okay, here's my friend. He's got a same-sex marriage. Now, in my world, that wouldn't happen. That wouldn't this or that. However, for me being forced to sit with you and reconcile with the fact that you have kids and this and that, no, I'm not going to push for a policy where your kids get confiscated. Now, it would be easier for me to do that if we never had these chats. And so I think one of the dangers of the laws that are being passed is they are trying to make these conversations less possible by inserting Joel's Islamophobic, therefore he can be deplatformed and whatever. Doesn't help. Whereas by having more of these chats, we can see each other as human and actually try and work out a middle path that we can work together on. And that's just an example topic. But the Islamophobia one's another topic where it's like we should have been able to chat for decades about Islam. When does it go too far? It's never happened. We've never been able to do that. And that's a problem.
Not to mention the fact, that we're being encouraged to think about treating sets of ideas with the same sorts of sensitivity as we treat human beings. Islam is a bunch of ideas that might be right or might be wrong. So is Christianity. So is Judaism. So is Marxism. So is like Foucauldianism or whatever. Muslims are human beings. And I only say this because a lot of the laws that they're proposing would not only make it a crime to demonize Muslims, which I'm more sympathetic towards hate speech laws that outlaw the incitement of violence towards people or the demonization of people, but would also make it a crime to, Islamophobia? Criticize Islam? Criticize them a bunch of ideas, a bunch of claims that a guy made centuries ago in the Middle East? That is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
We got to go. Let me just tell you some statistics about Australian well-being.
Hit me.
Real household income has gone up by 17% in the past 20 years. Household net worth is up 35% in the past 15 years. Infant mortality is down 30% in the past 20 years. Australian life expectancy is up 3 years in the past 20 years. Year 12 completion, so finishing high school, is up 9% in the past decade. University graduation is up 7% in the past decade. The homicide rate's down by a third in the past 20 years. The robbery rate's down by 60% over the past 20 years. GDP per capita has gone from 40 grand US 20 years ago to 64 grand US. It's not
that bad.
There's a lot to complain about. I am more worried than you are about handing the reins to people who don't know what they're doing but who talk in populist sound bites. So just be careful.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that.
Don't break my country.
No, I think Australia is a blip in history. I think the idea that we have an amazing standard of living, as you're pointing out, is brilliant. But whilst that is the situation, even though people are completing high school or degrees at a higher rate, the problem is standards are going down compared to the rest of the world in the OECD countries. We're seeing the fact that people can't afford their mortgages. Businesses are going out of business. I mean, construction companies, tens of thousands of them have gone out of business since COVID finished. So these are real things that are going on, and young people aren't able to get into the property industry at all. These are things we need to address, because it's like that saying, how did you go broke? First, gradually, then suddenly. We do live in an amazing country, which is why I fight for the ability to have these discussions and talk about potential solutions. I'm a 28-year-old guy, you know. I don't know everything, and that's why I'm really curious and high in openness about the solutions. But that starts with having great discussions. And as John Anderson would say, you can't get good policy out of a bad public debate. And that's why I really appreciate what you're doing here.
Joel, thank you.
Thank you.